Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, pretty baby, since you left me, I have been feeling oh so blue. I always thought that you would love me. I don't know what I should do. Do do.
Welcome to this, our first show for the month of March for Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. I am your host, Maria Wall. And this month, if you all have been following all of our promotions, the M not only stands for the month of March, but it also stands for our celebration of men. So the majority of our shows this month will be in celebration of men, and we're going to hear a lot of them share their stories of healing through hurt with us throughout this month. With that said, we're about to get the show started with a much anticipated guest. He is not only is he one of the longest living individuals on the planet with who's HIV positive, but he's also living with hemophilia and hepatitis C. He's the author of the book, Survivor, One Man's Battle with HIV, Hemophilia, and Hepatitis C. And, of course, with that said, I'm going to welcome tonight's guest, Mr. Vaughn Ripley, to the show. Vaughn, are you there?
I am. Hi, Maria. I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you so much for joining me here this evening on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. And I know that we had spoken briefly just a few moments ago, actually. And for those of you who are, of course, in our chat room, I want to say welcome to you. And, of course, if you have any type of question or comment for our guest this evening, feel free to type it in the chat room, and I will read it for you on air. In addition, of course, if you'd like to call in, our number is 646-478-4726, 646-478-4726 is our number. And with that said, of course, we're going to get started. Wow, where do we even begin with you? You know, I'd like to say that most people that knew about the show this evening had a lot of questions because they could not understand how you grew up with all of these ailments and how you managed to deal with them, so to speak. So many of them had that question, and as I told you earlier, in reading your book, I'm like, you were a typical boy. You were just...
I did the boy things, even though doctors and parents and friends and neighbors and everything told me as a hemophiliac that I couldn't. But, you know, boys will be boys, so... I have a lot of friends that are hemophiliacs or moms of hemophiliacs, and they have similar stories where it's sort of a nightmare that the kid still acts like he's a regular boy, and yet he's got this bleeding problem. So I wasn't going to let that hold me down.
Right. Which I can't say that I can understand that, because I think that I probably would have been one of those parents who was scared to death that the slightest little thing, and me growing up knowing kids that I grew up with who were actually suffering from hemophilia. And I knew what it was like when they were sitting out and, you know, not being able to do anything pretty much that I could remember from, you know, my childhood. But
yeah, wow. My hematologist wanted me to not participate in any sports. And he basically wanted me to be a bookworm. And when I used to come in to get Factor from accidents, skateboarding accidents or BMX bike accidents and things like that, or playing football with the guys in the neighborhood, he told me that I was shortening his lifespan.
His lifespan?
Yeah, I was driving him nuts. you know, but what are you going to do?
Right. So I guess we can start pretty much at, I guess, the starting point in your book as a whole, your younger years. There was one part in there where I thought it was so funny when you were talking about, I believe it was your younger brother, and you all were playing baseball or something. You had told him to go home.
Oh, yeah, my
that
poor younger brother.
Hilarious.
He was always the brunt of jokes anyway, so that was a tough one. And the older kids, you know, we just didn't realize that he didn't understand the terminology. So he didn't know that home plate was the name of the fourth base. And when everybody in the group started screaming, go home, go home, he just threw his face into his hands crying and sprinted to our house. And, you know, none of us knew what he was doing until later on when my mom explained it to us. So we felt pretty terrible about that.
Right. I think that, what was the name of the movie? Because I think it was The Sandlot, where was this kid and his friends, they were playing on this old vacant lot. And he had a little brother, too. And they were trying to tell him, because they finally let him get into the game, and they kept telling him to run home or go home. And he started crying, and he ran away, too. And I said, oh, my goodness, poor little fella. And I said, yeah, maybe you guys could get him the Sandlot and let him see that he was not the only one who misunderstood.
I fear that to this day he hasn't forgiven us for that. I think he thinks we were still trying to send him to the house.
No, that's why I thought about that. And I said, you know what? He did the same thing, and they did the same thing in that movie. And I said, maybe you could get him a copy of that as a gift and say, you know what? You're not the only one. He started crying, and he went running home.
In that movie, didn't they send him into the yard with the big dog, too?
Yeah, something like that. Was it him?
Yeah.
Was it he the one that went into the big, yeah, the infamous dog, and he was so gigantic.
Like a mastiff or something. Beautiful dog.
Yeah, but he was a mastiff, wasn't he? Was he?
I think so. One of those big slobbery dogs, maybe St. Bernard or mastiff.
No, he was a St. Bernard. That's what he was, I think. I think he was a St. Bernard, yeah. But anyway, I'm like, okay, well, that was the mild part of everything. After that, you just became, as I said, you know, for lack of better words, you just became hell on wheels. You were a typical boy. Now, me being a mother of a boy and then having grandsons, I'm like, wow, okay, boys will be boys, no matter what.
Yeah, it takes an awful lot to hold us down, that's for sure. You know,
but,
to some extent, I think I blame some of my adrenaline habits and all of the things that I do. I blame some of it on hemophilia, because if I hadn't been told on a constant basis that I couldn't do things, I think to some extent that's what happens to us as people. You know, if you get told over and over again that you can't do something, you pretty much go through life trying to prove those people wrong. And that's sort of something maybe that happened in my life to help me to be a little bit crazier.
Right. And I got that from reading the book, and I'm glad that you actually brought that up, because I think that, you know, you really did touch on something, because I created Healing Through Hurt because, you know, I basically should not have. Or, you know, people had told me to just shut up, be silent, you know, what happened, blah, 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 you are what, you know. So a lot of times, and in my life, I've done things because I was told that I should not or could not do them. So in that respect, I understand. But also, you had mentioned in the book that we're well aware that society tell it, or the medical experts tell it, your life expectancy was, you know, cut short, or much shorter than what most people would have been, had been expecting to live. So I think that, you know, you didn't let any grass grow under your feet, because with the conditions that you had, it was a touch and go, and you could be here today and gone tomorrow. So for that, I was like, kudos to you for living your life and not allowing any of your ailments to control your life, because no matter what, it was still your life, and you had every right to live it any way that you wanted to.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that you summed it up perfectly. You know, sometimes you don't really realize that that's the summation, but it just kind of happens that way, and you're right. I mean, I didn't want to be told that, and I certainly didn't want to live, you know, not being able to, quote-unquote, live. So I wanted to enjoy myself and enjoy my life, regardless of how long it was going to be.
Right, and then, and mind you, for all of our listeners, again, we are talking about someone who, you know, was very, very, very young, and you've had to deal with, you know, your illnesses for many, many years, and as we can see, you are still here. So I think that, you know, granted, some people will think, oh, the wonders of modern medicine, but I go a step further and think, oh, the wonders of Vaughn Ripley's, you know, human spirit, and your inner drive.
Well, and that's definitely, you know, it's funny that you mention it that way, too. Again, you know, back when I was early on fighting HIV, my doctors told me there was only one way for me to live an extended life once the medicine became available, and they said that it was by, you know, taking the medication on a regular basis and never missing it. And then there were friends of mine that were fitness buffs, and they said they knew the secret to beating this disease, and that was, you know, through fitness, weightlifting and staying really fit and eating nutritiously and everything. And then on the other hand, I had religious friends who said the only way to beat this virus was to pray, you know, and to have faith in God. And, I mean, it goes on and on. The list goes on and on. I mean, I have natural health friends who said yoga and things like acupuncture, which, by the way, as a hemophiliac, I would never even consider doing acupuncture. But, you know, I mean, there was just a list of friends and professionals and associates that told me all these different things. And I think, Maria, basically, I believe that I'm here today, alive and kicking, because I did a combination of all of those things. You know, I mean, along with having a positive attitude and stuff, I definitely followed what my doctors wanted with the medication. I worked on faith and spirituality and concentrating on that. I did daily meditations. I stay extremely fit, you know, through weightlifting, running, biking, swimming. And I think that it was a combination of all of those things that actually helped me to be here 25 years after the doctors told me that I had 2 years to live.
Wow. 2 years to live. And this was, how old were you then?
I was 19.
2 years. So once again, the wonders of modern medicine, because a textbook said that you should not have been here. Again, I still say kudos to your human spirit, because I believe, just from listening to you talk, that had so much more to do with it than anything else. But, you know, again, that's for, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong. But another thing that I wanted to touch on was the fact that you had said that, you know, kids weren't exactly very nice to you. So could you touch on that a little bit for us? Because I understand that perfectly well as well, growing up, and how cruel children seem to be becoming. And, you know, if they were cruel then, you know, they're 10 times worse now. So maybe someone who has a specific ailment that they're dealing with, this type of cruelty, maybe you can shed some light on that for them and tell us how you felt and how you dealt with it.
Yeah, definitely. During, like, junior high and into early part of high school, one of the things that really stood out was, like you said, kids have a natural tendency to kind of pick on each other. And then, you know, there's that extreme extent where you've got the bullies and stuff. And as soon as the bullies heard things like that, I had a bleeding disorder, they just ate that up. You know, I mean, it was like, are you telling me that if I punch you, you know, you'll swell up right in front of me kind of thing. And I was a little guy. You know, I didn't sprout until the 12th grade. In the 12th grade, I grew like 7 inches. So I finally got to the point, you know, as I was leaving school, where maybe I wouldn't be picked on as much. But leading up to that, I was just a little guy, and I was a bookworm and didn't do much participation in things because, you know, I was had all the doctors and parents and everything kind of keeping me away from those things. So I was also a little bit of a loner, so it was very easy to pick on me. And yeah, there were several occasions where somebody either hit me or was pushing me around or just, you know, in general. Sometimes it's even worse, the name-calling and, you know, just the nitpicking that somebody can do to you on a daily basis. Sometimes to me that's worse than getting slugged in the face, you know, which is a one-time thing and you just deal with it at that time. But I guess we all have to sort of deal with those demons. And some of the ways that I got around it, like I said, I would immerse myself in books, and I really got into things like Tolkien and some of the other, like, fantasy and then science fiction books and stuff. And I sort of found alternate worlds, if you will. And it was kind of neat to me because, you know, I could relate to some of the heroes in there and stuff, and I could, you know, relate to somebody in a fantasy book more so than I could with somebody like on a normal person in our planet. And that's one way that I carried myself through. Another thing that I did, and I like to pat myself on the back for this, but basically in the 9th grade near the end, I realized I was getting bullied a lot. So I went to the coach of the varsity football team. And I asked him, I said, you know, I would like to be the water boy. And it was actually on a recommendation of a friend who kind of pointed me in that direction. And it was probably the best thing that I could have done in high school because basically what that boiled down to was about 30 of the biggest guys in high school became my friend. And they became my friend pretty quickly, you know, because I was somebody that was trying to support the team even though I couldn't participate by playing. And those guys went through high school with me and protected me. So it was like one of those things where, you know, I kind of, here I was like the little tiny guy and the nerdy guy and didn't play football. And yet all of these big jocks who were all my good friends were there and hanging out with me and protecting me. So, I mean, that was one way also that I kind of made my way through high school without having too many problems.
And I guess we're just going to sort of follow the timeline from when you were told that I wrote some notes here for a second. Let's go back a little bit because, once again, as I said, welcome to all of our listeners and our guests this evening. For those of you on a switchboard, of course, if you'd like to be on air, press the number 1 on your phone. And, of course, I will bring you on air to speak with our guest tonight, Mr. Vaughn Ripley. He is the author of Survivor, One Man's Battle with HIV, Hemophilia, and Hepatitis C. And right now we're still in the phase of the hemophilia and being a young child growing up and adolescent and all of that with the hemophilia. And we're going to regress back a little bit because I have to bring up what I said earlier on is that you were a typical boy. Let's talk a bit about the scissors in the socket. Okay?
There's a typical boy, right? I knew somebody was going to call me out on that one. let me preface this by saying that my book, I wanted it to be a little bit different. I wanted to take the 100% honest approach. And by saying that, what I mean is I wanted it to be more like a diary. When you read it, Maria, I wanted you to feel like you were actually almost sneaking a peek in my diary, as opposed to just reading a book that I doctored up and, you know, kind of made myself look out like the perfect guy who never did anything wrong. So now we can jump into the scissors story, which is definitely one of my less fine points. But I had a little sister. I had two brothers and a little sister, and I was the oldest. So there were plenty of times and opportunities for me to pick on them and tease them and stuff. And in this one instance, I was pretty fascinated at the time. I don't remember how old I was, maybe about 10 years old. And I was fascinated with electricity and had been shocked once before. And so I decided to play a joke, if you will, which turns out that it's not a joke at all, because obviously, especially back then, before we had the GFCI breakers in the electrical sockets, which would save your life. But I decided I was going to try and trick my sister into sticking a pair of my mother's scissors into the electric socket. And to me, that was funny. Like, I guess, you know, it would be, like, entertaining to scare my sister with something like that. And the funny thing is she didn't fall for it. She was only about 5 or 6 at the time, and yet here she was, bright enough to know that her older brother was yanking her leg and, you know, trying to get her to do something that she shouldn't do. So good on her, and, you know, obviously a very bright little girl. But I decided to try and prove to her that it was safe and pretend to put the scissors in the socket. And obviously, you know, you all can see the direction this story's heading. But basically, I hovered the scissors right around the socket, right about a millimeter away from the plug, the socket arced to the scissors. And it basically blew me across the room. And that was quite a learning experience for me. For one thing, I mean, obviously, after that, I realized, my goodness, I should have never been trying to have my sister do that. But secondly, it was a very good learning experience for me and the power of electricity. I think everyone should shock themselves at least once, you know, so that you get that feel and realize, holy smokes, you know, this is not something to be playing with.
Okay, Don, no. Okay. I'm like, grandsons, if you're listening to this, the answer is no.
Don't they say that you learn by burning yourself on the stove? Oh my goodness.
Okay, seriously, children, grandsons especially, do not listen to Mr. Ripley, okay? You will feel grandma's wrath. Oh my goodness, okay. See, as I said, you know, you would not know with all of these ailments that you were such a typical boy. Don't get me wrong, I'm sure that people who have girls may have some stories too, but me being a mother and grandmother of little boys, yeah, you're pretty typical.
We find ways of getting into trouble.
Oh my goodness, you can be standing still and find a way to get yourself in trouble.
And don't let us find a creek. We'll come home head to toe covered with mud.
No. And bring in all kinds of vermin and things, and I'm like, that shouldn't be in the house. That's why it looks wet. Yeah. Been there, done that. But, you know, I just find it so, it's so inspirational, you know, the more to hear you talk about it and to bring the words that I read to life even makes it more inspirational to me and to other people who, they're just looking for someone like you, and they need to hear it. And especially, you know, now, because, you know, a lot of times we don't have men who will step up, who want to tell their stories one way or the other. So that's why I dedicated the month of March to men, because there are a lot of young boys out here who need to hear what you're saying, and I cannot relay that message to them. And,
yeah.
You know, even on the basis of girls listening, now they can hear, wow, this happened to a boy. You know, this happened to a male. So either way, you're doing a great service right now because there are young minds and even some adults or older adolescents that are listening to this that needed to hear this from you, because some things I cannot relay the same way that you can. So I want to thank you once again for joining me here tonight, because it is such a blessing to me. And, oh, my goodness, the listeners just jumped a lot. So welcome to all of our listeners. Again, we're here with Vaughn Ripley, the author of Survivor, One Man's Battle with HIV, Hemophilia, and Hepatitis C. We're going to move right along, of course, for our guests in the chat room. If you have a question or comment, feel free to type it in, and I will read it on air for you. And for our guests on the switchboard, if you'd like to call in, our number is 646-478-4726. Press the number 1 if you'd like to be on air. Okay, moving right along, let's come up a bit. I guess we can come up to the day when your parents had called you in, as you put it, I believe in the book, I think you said something that they had told you that you were dying or you were going to die.
Yeah. Basically, well, one thing, you know, hemophiliacs back in the 80s, a large majority of us became HIV positive. And
right.
The scary part is we didn't really know that was happening. Nobody came out and just said, you know, like, ah, there's danger with the blood supply. And I don't know if you remember back then, but HIV wasn't even called HIV. And actually, right before I found out, it wasn't even called AIDS. It was called GRID, which was gay-related immune deficiency. So the thing is, nobody, you know, I mean, I just assumed this isn't something, just like everybody else, nobody assumed that, you know, they could get it. That wasn't intravenous drug user or in the gay community. So I felt relatively safe. And it's funny, like I say safe, but the truth of the matter is I didn't even think about it because, you know, that's a level of safety in itself. If you're not thinking about or worrying about something, you know, that's a feeling of safety. And nobody told me or the majority of my friends that were hemophiliacs that there was this danger in the blood community. But clearly they knew about it in the mid-80s. And you're right. In 87, my parents called me into their den, and they explained to me that I was HIV positive. Now, they didn't know much about it either. They just knew, at the time it was called HDLV-3, but they didn't know what it meant. They just knew the doctor had called them and told them that I had this horrible, you know, virus and that I needed to come in and talk to him. So they brought me into his office, and he couldn't look at me. That's one thing, you know, he didn't even look me in the eyes. And I was a 19-year-old kid, but, I mean, I had enough knowledge to know, you know, like, here's this guy. He's not looking at me. What the heck is going on? And my mom started crying before he even really finished what he was saying. But basically, he just came out with it, you know. And back then, they just said you had AIDS because they didn't know all these different definitions and stuff. Shortly after I found out, they came up with this thing called ARC, which was a level before AIDS. I mean, there's a ton of terminology or whatever, but what it boiled down to is I had a blood-borne disorder, a disease, that was going to kill me. And that's what the doctor told me. While looking at his shoes, he told me, you know, you have AIDS and you have about 2 years to live. And that was it. You know, I mean, it shocked me to my bones. It's unimaginable to have somebody tell you something like that. And it's, you know, but people get it on a daily basis, somebody who has bone cancer or leukemia or all of these different things, you know. So I'm not saying that I was any different, but I was 19. So that's a little bit, there's a little bit more mystique involved with that because, you know, I was still a kid. And especially as a guy, we're talking about boys and stuff. Boys don't mature like girls do. And at 19, I was literally still a kid. So this doctor told me, you're going to die within 2 years. My parents both broke out crying. I started laughing, and I put that in the book. And the reason why I put that in the book is because I want people to understand an honest reaction. I didn't know how to react. It was such a shock to me. You know, inside, regardless whether I was crying or not, outside, all I could do was laugh. Because I was like, is this a joke? Is this real? You know, all these different feelings were going through me. And eventually that laughter turned to crying. And then my parents brought me out of there and brought me home. And we didn't do a whole lot of talking about it. I mean, it was just like, well, you know, you're dying, kid, so live with it. And that's one of the reasons why I think that I have a different outlook on life, because being 19 and facing death like that is something that I don't want to say it's a gift, but I do, because it really did open my eyes to life. I mean, the day before that happened, I was just some schmo, not really sure what I was going to do. Was I going to, you know, do college? Was I going to do in the workplace and blah, 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 and then retire and eventually end up in an old folks home? And didn't really think about my life. Instantly, that changed. I mean, in a matter of a blink, in a snap of the fingers, I suddenly was looking at life with a whole new, you know, breath. I mean, I was just, I couldn't imagine not thinking about life because I thought I only had 2 years to live. So it transformed me, and it turned me into somebody who learned immediately to appreciate life. Now, unfortunately, right after that happened, I also happened to fall into the wrong crowd, and I started getting involved with drugs. And I'm not one, I don't like to place blame, and I certainly don't believe in blaming like the world for my problems or my hurts or whatever. I feel that that would be weak of me to do that. So I basically look in the mirror. I'm not the kind of guy that looks through the window and blames everybody on the other side of the glass. I look in the mirror and say, look, if you can't handle this, it's because of you. So I'm not saying that it was other people or things like that or the tough things in life that got me on the drugs, but it was definitely a tough time for me. And I spiraled into a tailspin and essentially was doing the drugs because I just figured I'm dying anyway, so who cares? And nobody else really seems to care about me, so I'm just going to do this. And it was actually, it was two things. It was horrible. It was a horrible time of my life. But at the same time, again, it was enlightening. It's almost another experience that I learned, that I got to experience and live through, make it through, and learn that I never wanted to go there again. You know, it's kind of like they talk about the guy who hits bottom before he can finally get up and get past other levels that he was at. I think that's what happened to me. I had to sort of hit bottom and realize this is not a life that I want to lead before I could finally beat it and get past it.
Right. And I believe that right around the time when your parents got this particular bad news, so now you were already under the impression that you had a, you know, a shortened lifespan anyway because of the hemophilia. Then,
right,
your parents were already having some personal problems within the marriage, correct? Because I think you said that they were, you know, considering separating. And then the phone rings and they get this. So now you have hemophilia, who, you know, technically you should have been sitting down, not really doing much of anything, with a shorter life expectancy. Then you get a phone call, and now you're HIV positive. And, you know, I believe that they say that some people are HIV positive and then some people have full-blown AIDS.
Right.
So in your case, you were HIV positive, but back then they just knew that you had the virus. They didn't really, that was the beginning stages of AIDS, I believe, in the late 70s, early 80s, somewhere around in there, when it really came to the forefront, and nobody really had a clue one way or the other. But
to some extent, they still don't. It's kind of sad. I mean, it's amazing the science that's involved with it, but to some extent today, they still are very confused. They're finding now that there's multiple versions of HIV and there's different things. Some people who, you know, are HIV, it doesn't go into AIDS, and yet they die of other complications. So it's still sort of a medical mystery. You know, I think we're in the early stages of this. So it's just, you know, it's a medical miracle that I'm here. But at the same time, I mean, obviously I'm here because of medicine and, you know, all the things that we talked about before and the positive attitude.
Right. But initially, though, you were not taking any of the medications.
No, that's correct.
Point,
They didn't have, when I first found out, there wasn't even medication available. You know, AZT was the first medicine, and it became available right after. And then some of the medicines that I was taking, they were making me vomit so violently, I couldn't keep them down, and I actually couldn't keep any food down. So I just stopped taking the medicines.
Wow. And from that point, I know that you had gone into your spiral of the drugs and alcohol, correct?
It was both. It was drugs and alcohol. There was a lot of everything going on.
Wow. And, you know, I guess I'm still feeling it, that for all of our listeners, again, welcome this evening to Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio, where our guest this evening is the author of the book, One Man's Battle with HIV, Survivor, One Man's Battle with HIV, Hemophilia, and Hepatitis C. And this is a real, in-your-face look into the world of HIV, hemophilia, which many people probably do not even know anyone who suffers from any of these ailments, or maybe one of these ailments, or you know, two of these ailments. But to have someone here who is living with all three is a real eye-opener this evening. And I'm still in awe and at a loss for words, so to speak, because the more I listen to you talk, Vaughn, the more I'm almost putting myself in your shoes for a moment. And it's, for me, it's almost like, wow, these shoes are too big and too bulky and too heavy for me to even attempt to try to walk an inch in, much less a mile in these shoes. So
That's one of the things I love about human spirit, though. You know, I think that we all face, and I'll fall back on our demons again, but that everybody's demons are different. And the cool thing about humans is that we have the capability. I'm not saying that we all do it, but we have the capability within us to choose to do something in life despite the problems that you're facing. And that's what I love about humans. That's what I love about human nature. That's what I love about us as a whole, is that we do have that capability. It's built into us that we can stand tall against anything. And I honestly believe that. I believe it in my heart. Not all of us do. And, you know, I don't know what the reason is why someone does and someone doesn't. But I do think that it's amazing, some of the stories that you hear, some of the things that people have been through, and yet they persevere anyway.
And that's true, and that's why I always speak about that human spirit. And you touched on another great point, is the fact that each one of us has our problems and our issues, and we make it through somehow, because in hindsight, a lot of times, many of us don't even know how we did it. We just know that we did it. And, you know, when I say that, it's just a heavy burden, and to walk a mile in your shoes, you know, your burden is yours. And of course, mine belongs to me. But when you hear your story of triumph, I'm not saying that most people should look at that and say, oh, wow, you know, his hurt is so much worse than mine. What I'm saying is take what you're hearing from Vaughn and use that as that catalyst to help you continue to move forward. To listen to what he said and think to yourself, oh, my gosh, if he can do it, then that gives me the strength and the courage that I'll need to continue to put one foot in front of the other to move forward in my situation. Whatever your situation is to all of our listeners this evening, whatever you may be going through or whatever someone close to you may be going through, take these words and get out of it, if nothing else, get out of it that courage and that human spirit and pass that along, pay it forward as much as you can, because a lot of times it's these small things like a 1 or 2 hour radio show where someone can hear those very few words that they need to give them their aha moment where now they know or they have what they need to move forward or to wake up tomorrow morning with a different outlook on their lives, and they have a new game plan as to where they're going to go. Not saying that it's going to make your problems disappear, but at least now you're more prepared to deal with whatever may be coming your way. So, once again, welcome to all of our listeners. Thank you so much for joining me here this evening on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. For our guests in the chat room, if you have a question or comment, feel free to type it out, and I will read it for you on air. And if you would like to give us a call, our number is 646-478-4726. Press the number 1 on your phone to let me know that you have would like to be on air. Again, tonight is my very special guest, Mr. Vaughn Ripley. He is the author of his wonderful, wonderful memoir. It's entitled Survivor, One Man's Battle with HIV, Hemophilia, and Hepatitis C. And I cannot say that enough because, you know, for me, the more I have your book in my left hand as we speak, and the more I look at it, the more I'm still in shock and awe, and I'm still saying, wow. And there is one thing that I want to touch on, because I noticed the book itself on the cover. It's what appears to be fire. And I realize you had the curiosity with electricity. Once again, if my daughter-in-law is listening, cover my grandson's ears, because Vaughn was a typical boy, even with his ailments. Trust me, he was a typical male child. Okay, don't get me wrong. Some of you may think that your children are, you know, you may have children that were perfect angels, but you know, boys will be boys, and there's nothing wrong with that because a lot of boys are just that. They are straight-up boys. And Vaughn did not disappoint in that respect. You know, me as a parent and as a mother and grandmother of boys, okay, once again, I know my daughter-in-law is listening. Hide my grandson's ears because they do not need to hear some of the antics my guest this evening did as a boy. But I know you had a section in there about your love of fire. So.
Yeah, I definitely.
To me, yeah. The sofa incident. Yeah.
Oh, the sofa incident. Yes, yes, yes.
Uh-huh.
Well, let me first
mm-hmm.
just tell you the cover. It's funny because people have asked me, is it fire? Is it lava? It's actually a microscopic photo of the HIV virus. So,
oh, get out, really?
So it just says zoomed in, but it does kind of look like lava or fire, doesn't it? It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
But, yeah, okay, so I've always had a fascination with fire, and I think that that's perfectly normal, and I think it's actually safe as a hemophiliac. I'm not saying that it's safe as a boy, and especially being in a house or something like that, but as far as, like, you know, could I play Murder the Man with the Ball or light a fire, I think I'm a lot safer as a hemophiliac lighting a fire. That said, I do not condone the behavior that is going to be represented in this very next story. But me and a friend, we had a pile of fireworks that we had gotten, and it was cold outside, and I just remember thinking that we didn't really want to go outside anyway because we didn't want to get in trouble for lighting these fireworks off, but we really wanted to light them off. So one of us, and I don't even remember which one of us it was, decided that it would be a smart idea to light the fireworks off inside the house. And, I mean, as you can imagine, that's one of the stupidest things you've ever heard, obviously. But
yeah,
at
pretty
the time,
much.
It made sense at the time, though. So we found an old cardboard tube, and we decided it would be perfect for launching these bottle rockets out of inside of my apartment. And we put duct tape on one end of the tube so that the bottle rockets could launch without, you know, getting the flames and fire out of the back of them. And we stuffed the tube into my roommate's sofa. And then we proceeded to light bottle rockets and launch them into the room. And again, like you said, grandkids should have their ears plugged at this time because, I mean, this is a ridiculous story. But it was cool. I mean, it was like bottle rockets were bouncing off the wall. They were bouncing off the ceiling and, you know, just
right.
zooming around the room, just barely missing hitting us. And then they would blow up with a loud explosion. So, I mean, you can see from that perspective that obviously it's an idiotic thing to do, but you can see the enjoyment as kids. Like, it was enjoyable. We were having so much fun. And, you know, we'd probably done it for about 5 or 10 minutes maybe, and the whole room was full of smoke. And I just assumed that the smoke was because these bottle rockets launching through, you know, they leave a smoke stream, and then when they blow up, they do a little smoke. Well, it actually turned out the sofa was on fire. And that was because the bright idea of putting duct tape on the back end of the tube was not so bright after all. After several bottle rockets launched out of there, I guess they had burned through the duct tape, and then the fire just started going right into the couch, which, as pretty much everybody knows, couches are one of the most flammable things on the planet. So the couch pretty much just caught on fire and was burning pretty good. And we were able to manage the fire, put it out, and my roommate came home not too long after that, and the whole house smelled like it had burned down. So, because of all the fireworks we'd been doing in there, so I wasn't able to hide it from him. But it was a very entertaining thing. It's another one of those stories that I look back on and go, my goodness, I'm glad somebody didn't get their eye popped, you know, or something. But at the same time, it was an experience that I got to go through, you know. So, I mean, I lived it and I made it through it. So, like I said, I'm not condoning it, but it was something. It was something to see. But there you have it. And you're just picking these stories that are. Now your listeners are probably thinking, this guy's a wacko.
But you know what? Again, that's the whole point of me picking some of these. I'm a girly girl, so to me, no, that's not exciting and it's not funny, Vaughn. But again, you know what? Okay, great. You guys had a ball. Okay, no. But again, it's to set that point that you really, truly, madly, although you lived your life on the edge, you know, you didn't allow anything to stop you from living your life on your terms, even though that meant that you could have burned down the whole apartment complex. It's what you chose to do. You know, we can laugh about it now.
We can laugh because we made it through it.
Yeah, you made it through it. You made it through the fire, literally, so many ways. But and for our guests, of course, we're going to stop for one moment, and you can tell us where they can pick up a copy of your book, because I'm still looking at it now that I know that this is the HIV virus. Wow. Huh.
Yeah, it's kind of cool.
That is so cool now that I know, because I couldn't figure out what it was.
The book's available at all online retailers. So, I mean, Amazon, Borders, Barnes & Noble. You can also just go to my website, VaughnRipley.com. But, yeah, I mean, I had a lot of fun with the cover. Actually, two friends gave me the idea for it, and then I just used Photoshop and worked on the idea that they had given me and kind of carved it into what it is.
So you designed this yourself, actually, the cover.
I did. I did. Like I said, two friends actually had the idea. You know, they came up with the idea. It would be really cool if, because I'm also a retired rock climber. I know you haven't gotten to that part yet. But they thought it would be really cool if it was a picture of the virus and me climbing it. And the idea was, you know, it's kind of like you're slapping the virus in the face, because not only do you have this virus and you're dealing with it, but you're just out there climbing it. You know, you're not even worried about the fact that you have it. Let alone, you know, what it can do to you. Instead, you're out there enjoying yourself and just climbing the virus. So that was where the whole idea stemmed from.
We have a question in the chat room. TJ Dove
about
wants
burning
to know...
down my apartment.
No, not yet. TJ Dove would like to know if your book is available on Kindle.
It is, yes, actually, at the Amazon site in the Kindle book section. Mm-hmm. It is. It's on Kindle and it's on Nook and the PDF versions too. So I mean, it's available in all formats.
Oh, okay. There you go, TJ Dub. And of course, the name of the book is Survivor: A One Man's Battle with HIV, Hemophilia, and Hepatitis C. And it is available on Kindle. So that is good to know. You're going to love the book, by the way. I mean, it's just chock full of real life experiences. And, yeah, we're going to keep moving right along here. Rocket City Apartments. Look, that was on my list.
Electrocuting sister.
Oh, yeah. They electrocuted, tried to get the sister electrocuted. I did that. Bowl burns. Okay.
Oh, boy.
Okay. This, yeah.
Is this another one where we want the grandkids to plug their ears?
she says it's okay. Don't worry. They're not listening, LOL. So, TJ Dub said that they're going to download your book right now. So there you go.
Awesome.
So we're gonna
move into the bowl burn story?
You're darn right, because I'm a girly girl and you're a boy and you're still acting up. So, yeah.
We haven't gotten to the mature level of my book when I finally grew up at, you know, like 40 years old.
That'll be the last hour. We have 7 minutes left in the immaturity section. Then we'll get to the aha moments when you figured this all out, because right about now I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm having too much fun with the being a typical boy. So, let's start with the bowl burns. Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay, well, let's do a little bit of background again. Maybe some of your listeners don't even know what a bowl is, let alone a bowl burn. But during that time of my spiral, if you will, I smoked a lot of pot. And the way that we smoked pot usually was by using what's called a bowl. And it's essentially a pipe. The pipe has a small bowl on the end, and all of my friends that, you know, were doing this at the same time as me had these little bowl burns on themselves, and that was just, I don't know, it's another one of those guys will be guys, stupid things, but basically it's a matter of using a lighter to heat the bowl up until it was red hot, and then, you know, using it on your skin and burning a little circle on yourself. And it was sort of an insignia among my friends. And I decided I wanted to outdo everyone. And that's the summation of me and of my life. I'm always trying to figure out ways to outdo everything that I come across and how to do it, you know, 110%. In this case, I saw that everybody else had these small bowl burns, which are about a quarter of an inch in diameter. And I went out and I found a 1-inch diameter bowl, which was actually really thick, too. So it was just a huge piece of metal. And we heated it up until it was red hot. And I had a friend put it on my shoulder, and I wouldn't let him pull it off of because I wanted to make sure that it lasted. And actually, it's funny because we're talking about it right now. I just pulled my sleeve up and I'm looking. It's still there. And that was about 23 years ago. So, I mean, it was definitely a pretty severe burn. But basically, it sunk into my shoulder some as the bowl just melted into my flesh. And the idea was it's sort of like a tattoo except for that it's a burn. And the one thing that I didn't think about, the thing that's sort of ironic about it is, obviously it's an idiotic thing to do in the first place, but with me, with an immune system that basically was non-existent back then, I was dumber than any of my friends could have ever been by doing this because, you know, I opened myself up to infections and things like that at that time. It just kind of goes into the mentality. Like, I didn't put a whole lot of thought into that kind of thing. During those 2 years where I thought I was dying anyway, there was no real thought about things like, oh, my gosh, you know, you might get an infection by burning yourself, which is probably the worst thing that could have happened to me with that, if you set aside the fact that it was extremely painful and just a stupid thing to do. It was also potentially life-threatening. But, you know, here I am yet again to tell the story. So, I mean, I did make it through it. It's one of those things. But I do now as an adult, as a mature adult, what I like to consider somebody who fits in society, I have this big burn mark on my shoulder, you know. So it's sort of one of those things that occasionally at the pool or something like that, somebody will ask, hey, what's that? Because, you know, it's right above my shot. Us older folks have a little shot on our bicep from I think it was measles or something like that they gave us back in the 60s. So I have that little tiny scar, and then right above it I have this big, huge burn scar. So, but that's that story in a nutshell. And, I mean, obviously, again, I don't condone that behavior. I think that it was pretty ridiculous of me to do. But it is something that I did during that time and something that I live with on a daily basis.
Well, you know, the tagline for Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio is real people, real stories, real hurt, real healing. So it's real. I mean, it is what you had experienced and you have survived and lived through. So, you know, I guess with that said, we're going to move a little forward again to the point where you were on your knees and you were cursing God and all of that. And I think this was when we started to, it was the beginning of the turnaround, so to speak, before you may have tripped and fell maybe once during that time. But at one point you got to that point where you were cursing God for all of the things that had happened to you. And right now, have we gotten up to the hepatitis C yet? We've done.
No, I didn't find out about hepatitis C until I had turned my life around.
Okay.
I actually had had it since I was a child, but I just didn't know it.
So that was yet another blow to your system, a little bit down the road. But now we're going to get to your aha moment for our final hour. About our last 50 minutes or so, we're going to get to that point so you can tell us a little bit of when you had that aha moment and what made it happen.
Yeah, this is actually one of my more favorite parables in the book. It basically points to the time, like you said, where I was able to come out of the tailspin and turn my life around. But it also points to a time when I reached a heightened level of spirituality. And it also points to a time where I basically faced myself and everything about me. And like you said, basically on my knees, a broken man. And I stood up even though I was a broken man and was facing all of these problems. And what it happened was, it was basically at the end of the 2 years, At the time, I was a drug addict and an alcoholic, and I know actually I'm using that term wrong because people are going to chat now and say alcoholic is it's something that you have for life. But at the time, I had a severe alcohol problem, And that's mm-hmm. because I was just basically drinking all day long and you know, getting high all day long. And I wanted more out of life. And here I was right at the end of those 2 years, and I wasn't dead yet. So it was almost like an awakening moment for me. It was like, am I going to spend the rest of my life, like, am I going to keep living like this and then keep living, you know, being drunk and high all the time? This doesn't make any sense. This isn't who I am. It's not the man that I want to become. It's not anything to do with me. So it really shook me. And basically at that point, I had been in and out of, you know, religion all my life, and I knew that one solution that a lot of people have gone through and have found success with is praying to God. And I hadn't prayed to God in a long time, since I was a kid. So I was pretty angry because I felt like I was an innocent boy that got thrown into this, and I felt like I was being punished unfairly. So my prayer sort of turned dark. And like you mentioned, I mean, really what I did was it started out as a prayer, you know, asking for help and asking for a way out of this and asking for an answer. And it very quickly turned an other direction, like I said, a dark direction. And what it turned to was me more calling God out. And just saying, you know what, I mean, at this point, I'm not afraid to die. You're not scaring me kind of thing. You know, the guy who gets up on top of the hill and says, strike me dead with lightning kind of stuff. Stupid stuff. But at the same time, it gives you an insight to where my mental attitude was. I figured I was on the edge of death, and this was my last-ditch hope. So I screamed at God, and I screamed at God for about 2 hours. I screamed at him basically saying that I was done with this. I was ready to give in. I was ready to give up and not fight this battle for another day. And I gave God an ultimatum. I said, you show me a sign, or you come to me and show me a sign by tomorrow morning, or I'm going to kill myself. And again, it's one of those things where, you know, I look back on it and it's kind of something that I'm ashamed of, that I got to that point or that I felt at that point. But here we are in this, like you said, a talk show where we're being honest and everything. And I think the honesty and the reality here is all of us are capable of getting to a breaking point, and I had reached mine. So while on my knees, while screaming at God, I decided I was going to kill myself, and I told God that in the prayer. And I said, you know, I basically asked him, I told him, I want you to come down here and talk to me. I mean, he did it all the time in the Old Testament, right? So I was like, well, there's no reason why you can't do this for me. And I ended my prayer, and, you know, in tears, and just, like I said, a broken man. And I climbed into bed, and the funny thing is, I fell immediately asleep, and I slept like a baby. I hadn't slept well in the entire 2 years that I'd been dealing with this, because, you know, it was something that kept me up at night, shaking in bed or worrying about things. And here I was, knowing that tomorrow morning, I had promised myself I was going to kill myself, and I knew it. And it was almost like a comfort, because I had been dealing with this for so long, I was done. And I went to bed, I went to sleep, slept through the night, didn't have any problems, woke up the next morning, God hadn't come to me. So I got up, and I had a clear plan of what I was going to do to kill myself. And I was actually at that point, literally within moments of killing myself, and there was a knock at the front door. And the thing is, the hair on the back of my neck is standing up right now, and it's 23 years after this happened, but it's still, to this day, it's a clear thing that happened. And that is, the knock at the door happened literally seconds before I was going to kill myself. And I didn't want friends or anybody to happen upon me after killing myself. My plan was I was going to call 911 and tell them that I'd killed myself and then just hang up the phone, so that you know, police and ambulance would show up, they could take care of that, and my friends wouldn't have to deal with it. So having somebody at the door sort of really beat on my conscience. I was like, well, you know, I don't know who it is. I don't know what's going on. I got to go and get the door. Then I can always do this in a couple minutes. So what it boils down to is I got up, I went out to the front door, opened it up, and standing before me was a friend of mine from when I was 12 years old, somebody I hadn't seen literally in a decade, who was from my church from when I was a kid. And, I mean, another, just to kind of make this a little bit more real, I was now living in, like, the fifth place that I'd lived in over the last couple months. So, I mean, just for somebody, and one of my friends, let alone somebody I hadn't seen in a decade, to find me was practically impossible. And here he was, standing at my door. And he told me, I just got back from Brazil. He had been in Brazil for 2 years on a mission doing work for the church. And he said when he got home, he just got a feeling that he needed to seek me out and find me. And I can't explain, unless you've had a feeling like that, I can't explain, but it was just the most amazing thing to me. And to me, it was an answer. Now, whether you're Christian and you believe in God, or you know, or you don't believe in God at all, or you just believe in a higher power, or you believe in like Rhonda's book, The Secret, you know, where you basically draw things to you through the universe. Regardless of how you believe it, there's one thing that I know for sure. David, my friend, was at my door there because of my prayer the night before. I drew him to my house through God, through the secret of the universe, through whatever. But it was an eye-opener to me. And at that moment, I knew that my life was going to turn around. And literally, in that instant, I knew my life was going to turn around. And I stopped doing the drugs, and I stopped drinking, and I didn't look back. And, I mean, that's just, you know, like I said, it's one of my favorite parts of the book, and really because it's sort of like the central, you know, the nucleus of my whole story. I wouldn't be here today if that situation hadn't happened, regardless of whether I went through and committed suicide or regardless of whether the HIV killed me or whatever. I'm here to tell you, I wouldn't be here today if that exact story hadn't happened. So that's that one in a nutshell. And I know I dragged it out for a little while, but I wanted to really bring it home and have everybody be able to feel, you know, a little bit of what I was feeling when it happened to me.
And I think that, you know, a lot of people don't seem to understand that we're all connected in this world, and there is a being or whatever you want to call it, or him, or whatever name you choose to give it, there is something much higher than us. And we need to understand that we are not in total control. There is something else, someone else, however you want to say it, that's watching over us. And I know that I was always taught, you know, growing up that, you know, where God is concerned, all you have to do is ask.
Right.
He's going to hear you. And so many times we want what we want when we want it. But I always tell people that, you know what, it doesn't happen in my time. It happens in God's time. And it's amazing how he manages to step in right when you need him to step in.
Yeah.
And so I understand totally. I understand totally what you're saying. And it's amazing that what the power of faith and prayer and that humbling effect that we have to have for ourselves sometime to be able to even ask for that help is so amazing. And, you know, there are people every day that are in my life that they don't even know how much of a blessing they are for me to help keep me moving forward every single day.
Yeah.
And it's the small things that they say and do that help keep me going. And it's the hearing of your story that helps to keep me going. You know, a lot of times, you know, kind of sort of like now, I can sit here and listen to someone's story, and I have tears in my eyes, because it's like, wow, you know, that really hit home for me. And, yeah, I feel you. I'm with you. I understand. And that's actually, you know, where I am right now. So I'm sure that there are a lot of listeners out there who are feeling the same thing. So, yeah, it's really, yeah, you brought it home in a nice way. And there's a comment in the chat room. TJ Dub said that your book has been purchased. So, well, congrats on it.
Yay. Well, I hope that I'm able to inspire TJ in some way or another. I mean, it's very important to me. That's one of the most important things to me at this stage of my life is not only being a motivation and inspirational, but also maybe just being a role model for people to know that you are capable of doing more than you can imagine. And, you know, we're all so capable. I just want everybody to understand that.
Right. And I believe that you said it earlier. You sometimes we have to hit that rock bottom place before we can start to bounce back to a level that's even higher than the level that we were at when we started our downward spiral.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I understand that. And once you've had a major blow to your life or a tragic event or something happened to you, you do have a different outlook on life, and you do see life in a different way. And I preach, live life like it's your last moments on earth. You know, dance like no one is watching. And dance like, even if they are watching, dance. You know, enjoy yourself. Do what you want to do. And get the word out. Pay it forward. Pay it forward. You know, what you do is because you felt the need, you were compelled to pay it forward. And what I do, I'm compelled to do this. You know, we have to share in our hurt and our pain and our sorrows, because for every time somebody hears your story, and thousands of people are going to hear your story, hundreds, maybe thousands, you know, usually it's thousands for this show. So, you know, you're going to help someone. You're going to help someone dry those tears that they've been crying for what seems like an eternity.
Yeah.
And
that's just such a cool feeling, you know. Even it, and you know this. I mean, even if, like with your show, if you can touch one person today, and
exactly,
just help inspire them, help to motivate them to do something, to step up and do something a little bit more than they would have done previously listening to your show. That's what it's all about.
Right. Exactly. And again, for all of our listeners, welcome to Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. Thank you so much for joining me here this evening. Of course, as always, I am your host, Maria Wall, and we're here tonight with my special guest, Mr. Vaughn Ripley. He is the author of Survivor, One Man's Battle with HIV, Hemophilia, and Hepatitis C, and he has touched someone tonight, as a matter of fact, in our chat room. We do know that someone has already gone and made that purchase of his great, wonderful book. It's a great read. It's very down to earth. It's an easy read for you, and it's straightforward, and it's his life. He didn't sugarcoat anything. He did not try to make you think that it was one way when it was another. It's raw. It's straightforward. It is his life as he has been living it all these years. And this is someone who is living with, of course, as I stated, HIV, hemophilia, and Hep C. So, you know, again, people, this is about living your life and not allowing whatever ailment or problem you may have to dictate to you how you're going to live your life. Take control, and because life is a precious thing, and there's no guarantees or proof that we get a chance to come back and do it all over again and try to change things. So we have to live it to the fullest while we're here this time. And each of us has a story, and, you know, it takes a very special group of people who can come before thousands of people and tell them, I come to you as a broken person. And I don't say I was broken. For me, I'm still broken, but I'm mending every day. Every week that I do this show and I have on a guest such as Vaughn, it helps me to get a little bit closer to my healing. And I know it's going to take a long time because, you know, everything that I'm going through is, of course, it's still fresh. But every week that I do this show, you know, I do it, you know, I created it for, I guess you could say, some selfish reasons, because I knew that by me helping to heal others and having this venue for people to share their stories, that I knew that I would be helping myself as well. So this is for all of you, and I hope that you get something out of it and that you enjoy Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio and you come back often. And, of course, this is not Vaughn's first visit. I will, of course, keep in touch, and we'll have him back when he, if he decides to write another great book. And, you know, we're going to come up because we only have about 40 minutes or so left. We're going to come up to you, the kids, your wife, some of the other great things you do with your life. Of course, your rock climbing, which I think is kind of neat and cool. I also like the motorcycle, too, but that's for another show. So, yeah, we can bring it to a summary now and kind of close off with a little bit about your family and the rock climbing. You know, I always wanted to do that. That's on my bucket list. I was going to go to one of those places where they have the rock climbing wall just to make sure that I really do like this. But
yeah, out by you, there's Earth Treks in Colombia out by you, not too far
mm-hmm.
from you. And the indoor gyms are actually pretty fun to to definitely to find out if it is something that would be an experience that you would enjoy. Rock climbing is pretty amazing. I got out on the real rock, up a lot of climbing up past you in a place called Rock State Park, which is,
mm-hmm.
The next county up, I think it's Hartford County, and
mm-hmm.
also down by on the Potomac River at Carter Rock and Great Falls, and also went up to New York to the Gunks, and I often went down to West Virginia to a place called Seneca Rocks. And I've also done some climbing out west. I've climbed in Arizona and Washington State and a little in Idaho. So, I mean, I've gotten around and had a lot of fun with the climbing. But like I said earlier, I retired. I did about, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 years of climbing. And when my wife and I were pregnant with my daughter, I kind of sort of had an eye-opening experience that basically told me that I was vulnerable for the first time in my life. And, as you've said and as you saw through the book, I pretty much did a lot of crazy stuff, especially as a hemophiliac. And so it might surprise a lot of people to hear that I was out rock climbing and doing lead climbing, as a matter of fact. So, I could take a 20-foot fall doing a lead climb if I was past my latest piece of protection. And that's a serious fall for anybody, let alone a hemophiliac. And once we had my daughter Trinity on the way, it was one of those things that was like, what am I doing? I'm out here, I'm recklessly, not even thinking about anything. And she brought me back down to earth. She literally did the next stage of my life, changing me. And that was to take me away from some of my adrenaline things. Like you mentioned, the motorcycles, racing motorcycles at the racetrack, and also racing them on the street, for that matter. But it was just, it's amazing what a child can do for you. And there's so many different levels of what they can do, but not the least of which was she literally just brought me, like I said, back down to earth. And again, maybe saved me. I mean, so many things in my life have been there at the right moments and stuff to sort of keep guiding me along the way. And that's also why I like to fall back on the idea that there is a higher power. There is somebody, something, in my mind, it's God. And there's something out there that's always looking out for us and always doing things for us. And from that perspective, you know, also, we couldn't have even had children 7 or 8 years ago. It wasn't even possible unless we wanted to take the chance of me getting my wife and or my children HIV positive. So that wasn't even an option for us. And then suddenly, you know, science made adjustments, and there was a medical breakthrough, and I consider it also a miracle, something that was given to us by that creator that gave us the opportunity to use a new form of in vitro fertilization and allow us to have our own children. And it's a miracle, and it's a miracle that I respect and am happy about every single day. I wake up in the morning, and I'm literally just in awe of the miracle that gave us our children. And it's an amazing thing. And I love those kinds of things. Those kinds of things just inspire me on a daily basis. And that's just one of, you know, many things that do. But having kids, as you know, it's a whole nother world. I mean, there's a lot of down, too. Don't get me wrong. It's like they drive me nuts sometimes. But but it's the most amazing thing. You know, I heard so many of my friends and my brother that had kids telling me this stuff, and I'm like, you know, they don't know what they're talking about, blah, blah, blah. But once we had kids, it's like I realized it. They are amazing, you know, and they really are so special, and they add so much to our lives. It just, I can't imagine life without them now.
Wow, I know. They can be a handful, and then they can be, and they just love you so unconditionally, and some days you're just like, you just want to scream, but, and I think that it's also a testimony as well that you have a strong, obviously it sounds like you have a very healthy and strong marriage.
Yeah, we do. And actually, I know there's part of the book that you're probably dying to get out there that we can talk about. But, I mean, it's one of the things that actually strengthened our marriage and took it to a new level. And that was chapter 25. That's my affair. And that's another thing. I mean, there are so many things in the book that I say I'm not proud of that. But it's one of those things that I couldn't not write about. I feel like, at the time, I felt like an utter failure for doing such a stupid thing, because it's something that up to that point I had never imagined making such a stupid choice. But, you know, I think sometimes that's why we make the stupid choices, because you go through life not ever imagining that you could do it, and then you don't have a plan B. It's not something, you know, that you're protected from. And that's not an excuse. It's just something that I think that does happen to us. Sometimes things creep up to us in our lives, and we make mistakes. And the problem is that my mistake, my having an affair, was a mistake that I can't undo and that I will live with for the rest of my life. You know, just like this burn on my shoulder, it's a scarlet letter on me, and it's something that I can't get rid of. That said, it empowered my marriage, and it empowered me and it empowered my wife to understand and to really appreciate what we had. You know, at the time, we had been married for about a dozen years, and you know, it was like sort of that flat point in our marriage, and it was something that is a struggle that I'm sure everybody goes through at some point in a marriage. But it wasn't the right choice. It wasn't the right thing to do. However, it is something that has strengthened my life and strengthened my connection with my soulmate. You know, my wife and I are closer than we've ever been in our lives. And fortunately for me, she was willing to stay with this idiot after he made, you know, this horrible decision that he made. But what it boiled down to is I stepped out there made a tremendous mistake, a tremendous decision in the wrong direction, and took the wrong path for a short period of time and just keep kicking myself to this day. You know, I mean, five and a half years ago that this happened. But it had to make the book. I had to put it in there. I would consider myself a hypocrite if I could write this stuff. You know, like I said early on in the show, I'm not going to put the book out there and make myself just look like this hero who has, you know, beaten HIV and, you know, is still alive today, blah, blah, blah. But I want to humanize myself. And I'm not saying that like I'm writing about a fictional character. I'm saying it like I want you to know the truth. I want you to know about me that I am a man. And that's another thing that maybe brings it down to earth for people, realizing, and hopefully that's inspirational to people, that I'm human. I mean, I make mistakes just like everybody else. There's no question. I've made a ton of them, believe me, probably more than a lot of your listeners. But I'm still here. I'm still learning. And I take every day I learn something from that day, and I try and build that into something powerful, something that will help to improve me. One of my favorite mentors is Tony Robbins. You know, he's a guy that does a whole lot of CDs and stuff like that that's inspirational and motivational. I also like Stephen Covey and guys like that. But one of the things that Tony Robbins says is he has this thing, it's called CANI, and that's constant and never-ending improvement. And what that boils down to is on a daily basis, you have to improve yourself. And so I try to do that every day, and I feel like that's one of the things that's made me successful in the things that I do. It's how I accomplished writing my book. It's how I've done so many things. And when I had the affair, it fell into that category of you've got to learn something from this. You've done something horrible here, so you've got a lot of healing time to do with your wife and family. But secondly, you've got to come out of this with something learned and something that you know will stick with you for the rest of your life. And I believe that it did. It empowered me to understand, first off, how lucky I am, you know, to have a wife who stuck with me. When we started dating, I was HIV positive. I mean, just imagine from that perspective how amazing this woman is, you know, that put yourselves in her shoes. How many women out there are going to date, let alone marry, a guy who's HIV positive they don't think is going to live for that long and they know they can't have children with? This is an angel. And here I was just scrapping that, really, you know, taking it right to the edge and almost destroying that relationship. Fortunately, like I said, she is an angel. And so we worked through my discretion, my horrible, you know, dark moment. One of a dozen dark moments. But, you know, we did. We struggled through it, and we worked through it, and we built it, and we empowered ourselves. We made our relationship stronger than ever. And I'm proud to say that, you know, to this day, I honestly feel that. We get stronger day in and day out. And, I mean, I think a lot of people's relationships end on situations like that. And I think that actually it's probably a leading cause for divorces and separations and stuff. But we were able to work through that. Just like, you know, together we've worked through a bunch of other things in life, we were able to work through that. And I owe her for that, because she was there for me, even in my darkest hour with her and our relationship.
And so,
that's that.
I just want to, and for some of our listeners, you know, the title of the show is Healing Through Hurt. And for some of our female listeners, I know that you're probably up in arms, but from a female perspective and someone who is newly divorced because of my husband's indiscretions, the fact that he did not ask forgiveness, he did not want to acknowledge what he had done, and matter of fact, he ended up hurting me, because when he was discovered, he did not want to be a man about it and do what you have just done. So in that respect, I give you much respect for being a man about it and doing that. Of course, in my situation, we just divorced in December of 2010, and he made it a point to leave me to destroy everything that I had built and had before we even married. So, you know, this is someone who did the opposite of what you have done. So, in essence, for all of the ladies listening who are up in arms about this, you know, what Vaughn has done is what a real man should and would do. And
I really appreciate that. I'm very sorry that you went through that. And I, you know, this, like I said, it's one of those things that I deal with on a daily basis, because it is a terrible thing that I did, and it's a mistake that I'll live with for the rest of my life. But I see what you're saying, and I totally agree. I mean, you know, marriage is it's something that is between two people, not one person.
Right.
Not one person trying to work through the problems of two people. It's something that is between two people, and it was tough asking for forgiveness and doing those things. It was tough, but at the same time, it was, like you said, it was the right thing to do, and that's one thing that I do pride myself with. I make a lot of stupid decisions, and I have done stupid things in my life. But one thing that I will do is I will try and do the honorable thing. When I get to the point where I realize what I did was completely ridiculous or out of hand or a terrible thing, I turn around and I try as hard as I can to do the honorable thing and make it right. And I think that's something that helped us through all of this. Like I said, too, you know, I mean, obviously she had a lot of play in it, but I mean, it took both of us to be able to do it.
Right.
And I think what that boils down to in your situation was, maybe if you were trying to do it on your own, that's not something that you can struggle through as a couple. It takes both people. It takes two people to tango in the beginning, and it takes two people to heal through problems of a couple.
Yeah, well, you know, at that point, when the violence came into the picture, I knew that it was pretty much a done deal for us. And, you know, when suddenly you're with a stranger in your own home, you know, we'd all know when it's time to just, you know, hold them and fold them, so to speak. And it was time for me to move on and throw in the towel, because I'm sure that had I been a weaker woman who stayed with this person, I'm pretty sure, I can pretty say with most certainty that I would not be here today to be talking with you to hear this, because he's definitely a sociopathic narcissist. So, you know, for me, ladies, like I said, you know, this is someone who you should be praising for what he did. I'm not saying, you know, we're not condoning the action itself, but if you've done something, then be a man or a woman about it. Admit to it and try to move on and mend things from there. But when there is nothing left to mend, then, you know, life is more precious than having that warm body laying next to you at night that feels like you're outside in the blustering cold. So, you know, it's just something to think about. So, as a woman speaking to you as a man, again, and some people may not agree, but it takes a good man and a real man to admit to his mistakes and try to do the right thing and continue to do the right thing from that point on, as opposed to some of the people that we choose to hold on to when there's really nothing there to hold on to. Really quickly here, just a few announcements. Thank you all again for joining us. We'll be returning back to Vaughn to wrap this up in a few minutes. But as always, Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio is a subsidiary of the Wall Foundation Incorporated, which is a 501c3 nonprofit. We are fully privately funded, meaning we don't get anything from the government. We get it from listeners and supporters such as you. It helps to keep our programs going in the community as well as here on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. If you'd like to give us a call at any time, our number is 202-618-2556, or you can write to us at Post Office Box 272, Randallstown, Maryland, 21133, or you can email us at contact@thewallfoundationinc.org. And, of course, join us here tomorrow morning for our regular Sunday morning meditation, which is at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Of course, it's just 15 minutes of stress relief and release. And, of course, next week we will have the Helping Up Mission out of Baltimore City. They service over 400 men, and they will be here with some of their program participants to share their stories of healing through their hurt. As I said, the month of March is in celebration of wonderful, great, beautiful, handsome men. So this month we're going to be hearing the stories from the male perspective, which a lot of time goes under the radar, and we really do not give the proper attention to our male counterparts. So this month is the month of men here at Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. Again, for our guests that are still in our chat room, if you have a question or comment, feel free to type it out, and I will read it to Vaughn for you on air. And if you'd like to be on air, if you're in our call query, of course, you can press the number 1 on your phone, and that will let me know that you would like to be on air. And to all of our other listeners who are chiming in through our media players, thank you so much for joining us here this evening on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. And once again, we are here with Vaughn Ripley. He is the author of Survivor, One Man's Battle with HIV, Hemophilia, and Hepatitis C. Great book, great individual, wonderful story, real story, straight in your face, raw. And when I say raw, I don't mean raunchy raw. I mean that it's as real as it can get. He did not hold anything back, as you can hear. And, of course, for those of you that came late to the chat or through the player, as soon as our show ends, you'll be able to hear it in its entirety in our archives. I will be putting it up as our featured show, so you can click on it and hear it from beginning to end. So we have about, 20 minutes left or so. So we're going to start, 22, I was close. So, you know, there was one thing that I did want to touch on before we ended the show was that your wife and you had talked about having children, and I believe that she had wanted to have a legacy to carry on.
Yeah, that was something that was very important to her. I think I had sort of, you know, I realized 20 years ago there's no way I was going to have kids, so it wasn't something that I was dealing with on a daily basis. What I overlooked is the fact that, you know, as a woman and her motherly instinct and everything was really kicking in, whereas I was kind of able to separate it from myself and just realize, hey, I can't have kids. You know, it's unfortunate, but I can't, so I'm just going to get on. And for her, it was more, you know, she wanted to have kids, but she knew that by being with me, that probably was impossible. Yet she thought about it on a pretty regular basis. And at some point, you know, she eventually, we started talking about it, and I actually talked to her about adopting because, you know, that was an option that I thought that we had available to us or whatever. And it actually turned out that that might have been tougher than we thought because one parent who, you know, you can't prove how much longer that parent can live or whatever, it's going to make it a little bit of a tougher scenario for adoption. But it didn't matter because it turned out my wife didn't want that. She, as much as we love the idea of adopting and everything, that wasn't in her cards. To her, she wanted to have, like you said, a legacy. She wanted to have me, or, you know, something from my lineage. And she even got to the point where she was asking me about my father, like maybe she could do in vitro with him. And it, he turns out that he had a vasectomy. like 30 years ago, so it wasn't even a possibility. So it was something that she fought with on a regular basis. And what I had mentioned earlier about the miracle actually came up in Europe first, because, you know, a lot of times things like that do happen that way. But Italy was starting to do this form of in vitro where they actually pull individual sperm out, and they're able to test the individual sperm for the HIV virus, and then they can inseminate an egg. And that process is called ICSI, I-C-S-I, and it stands for something along the lines of intercytoplasmic something or other. But basically what it boils down to is pulling an individual sperm out, and after testing for HIV, then being able to impregnate an egg and putting that egg back into her. And that's why I say it's kind of a modern miracle, you know. I mean, it's really amazing, the technology that we're talking about at a microscopic level, them being able to do that. But we had planned to go to Italy, and what that was going to mean was our life savings and everything, because it was going to cost us a fortune to do that. And right as we were getting to the point of going over to Italy and going ahead and being one of the first test cases in this, we heard that it was coming to America. And so we ended up talking to some doctors up in Boston and also down in Norfolk, Virginia and stuff. And they said that, yeah, the program was coming. So we decided to wait. And we went through several in vitro fertilization attempts before we actually had our kids. We've actually done 5 attempts and had 2 kids. And we had one girl and one boy. So I consider that the golden ratio. I feel like we're pretty blessed. You know, we feel like we got exactly what we wanted, because we have one of each of, you know, the most amazing miracle you can have in your life, and we had one of each. And it's just something that we feel so blessed, you know, like I said before, on a regular basis. It's just amazing that it was able to happen in our lives, because, like I said, I was resolved to the fact that I just couldn't have kids, and now here we are raising 2 of our own. It's pretty amazing.
And they are healthy, and I know they're giving you both a fit. And being as little people do. And how old are they again?
Trinity is 6 and Xander is 3. They're little maniacs. They like to fight with each other over toys and things like that. But for the most part, they're just wonderful. Like you said, it's amazing. It's almost like coming home to the dog. You know, we have a lab, and it doesn't matter what time of the day or how often I come home, he's sitting there with his tail wagging, and he just loves me, you know? And that's the way that the kids are. I mean, I walk in the door, and they both scream, Daddy, and they come running across the room, and they jump on me. I mean, it's just every time I walk in the door, you know? I think that us adults, you know, we could learn something from them. Can you imagine how we would all feel about each other if every time we saw each other, we ran screaming? If the next time I see you at, you know, Red Lobster or something, I just ran over to you and said, Maria, and ran and jumped on you and hugged you. I mean, just imagine how exciting that would be for all of us. You know, it's funny how we kind of grow out of that, but you get to see it with the kids, and it's like, wow, you know, I'm loved, aren't you? It's like something really precious to have them react like that when you get home. It's wonderful having that love in the house.
Well, you have to come up when I do my summit this summer. You'll have to come up, and we do hug each other at the summit, especially if I have show guests. It's like, oh, my gosh, Vaughn, hey! You know? We have a great time, and I do have former show guests. And you come, you bring your books, and, you know, you have your own spot set up, and people can talk to you, and you'll be able to have your booth, and they can get a copy of your book if they like. And in the meantime, before we leave tonight, again, tell everyone where they can purchase your book and how they can reach you if they want to talk to you personally.
Okay. Yeah, the easiest thing, like we were talking about, the book is available at all online retailers. And I guess, like you mentioned, including on the e-book formats like Kindle and Nook and PDF files and things like that. And it's available at Amazon, Borders, Barnes & Noble, all the online sites. You can also get it through my personal website, www.vaughnripley.com. And that's also how you can contact me on my website. I've got a contact page on there. And on that contact page, you can write to me, and it comes directly to my email. You can also just email me directly. My email address is survivor@vaughnripley.com. So, and I love hearing from folks. I love, you know, talking about the book or life or anything. And I'm actually also a certified personal trainer. So I do a lot of things with fitness. And so a lot of people that I communicate with and stuff is on a fitness level. I'm a triathlete at this stage, which actually has worked out pretty good for me as a hemophiliac. And it's a pretty exciting thing for me, because at the same time as getting to have the excitement of the sport and the adventure of racing, I also stay fantastically fit. So it's sort of like the double whammy. I get to have the fun of the sport and the race, and at the same time keep myself, my body, my temple, I keep it 100%. And, you know, it's just a pretty amazing thing. So if you just want to email and talk about things like fitness and stuff like that, or shoot the breeze about life, philosophy, whatever, I'm here, and I dig doing all of it.
Cool. I might have to call you about the fitness thing. I'm a certified fitness professional, but I'm certified in children's fitness. So, you know,
cool.
Even though it's not that different, but, you know, it's kind of fun. And I'd have some of my coworkers, I'm like, we can call Vaughn and he could do a whole regimen for us. You know, right now we're talking about doing the Zumba classes, but
yep.
We just want to get in shape before the end of the year. So
yeah.
We've got time. And, you know, now I need to work on getting me healthy again and back on track. So,
The physical side is very important, and I think sometimes it's something that a lot of us overlook. I mean, when you're healing, you know, and that's what your whole show is about, it's not just a mental healing. It's not just physically healing from, you know, the physical abuse that you dealt with. It's also physical fitness in and of itself is mentally healing. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be very healing and good for you.
Yeah, it is. It really is. And for those of you listening, you know, do something. That's what I do, the Sunday morning meditation about. Sometimes we do simple relaxation techniques and breathing and some exercises that just help you to relieve that tension that so many of us are carrying around nowadays. You know, we let loose of whatever happened last week, and then, you know, it helps us to deal with what may be coming, you know, this week. So it's just a simple 15 minutes, because so many people are so busy ripping and running, they don't even take 15 minutes for themselves. So it's just
meditation
another way.
Meditation is amazing.
Yes.
Meditation.
So
do you do yoga?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really like yoga, and I like I like the meditation, I like the yoga, and I like those aspects too of fitness. I think it's pretty amazing and helps you to really reach your inner self.
Yes, and yoga is a wonderful thing for people. If you don't want something that's really high impact, you'd be surprised what yoga could do for you. So, once again, it's just great. And wow, we've touched on quite a bit in our 2 hours, and as always, it goes by so quickly that it's always amazing to me. But we have about 10 minutes left in the show, so I know that you had touched on it a little bit, but of course, what do you do to, I know that in the book, I believe that you said that I know that you drink X amount. You drink a gallon or more of water every day.
Yeah, I do. 204 ounces of water a day.
Wow.
It's a good bit. I super hydrate.
I don't know if I would do that. I don't know. I'd probably be running back and forth across the floor to other places than my desk.
Yeah, your bladder grows. I do that, and I try and eat nutritiously. Like I mentioned, you know, I work out adamantly. I do some weight training, and I love to ride my bike and run, and I do some swimming, and all of those fall into the triathlon thing. I try and get yoga in when I can. But one of the things that I think has really helped a lot, along with the medication that I take, I do a routine on a daily basis that is a meditation routine. And I kind of get myself into zone before I take my medicine, because something that I struggled with years ago was every time that I took my medicine, I realized I was taking my medicine, and at the same time, I was poisoning my body because I was thinking, I'm taking this medicine to prolong my death. Do you know what I mean? It was like, mentally, I was telling myself, without even really thinking about it, these are the kinds of things that we do on a daily basis, by the way. You know, you think 1,000 thoughts an hour, so, I mean, you're constantly thinking things. And the question is, are you thinking positive things, or are you thinking negative things? And negative things can really eat you up. And that one thing, I think, made a big difference. My CD4 counts never stayed high, and I always had problems with my immune system, until one day I realized I was doing that. I was sitting there taking my medicine, and I was thinking, I'm sitting here thinking I'm dying, and that's why I'm taking this medicine. So I decided to try an experiment, and I experimented with it for about 2 months and realized my health completely turned around. And that is that instead, when I was taking it, I started actually thinking more on a positive side, that, you know, this is the thing that's going to empower me to live a normal life, and thinking more positive about those things. And then I took it even a step further, and I started thinking about generals from the Civil War, and especially Sherman, and I think of each of those pills as generals, and those generals are calling up my white blood cells, which are their army, and I literally sit there, and I mentally fall into this meditation, and I imagine the millions of white blood cells just scouring my body, going through my body and finding, you know, viruses and illness and things like that in there, and going to battle, you know, fighting with the viruses and anything that is a problem in my body. And I go from head to toe. It's like an Ayurvedic thing that I learned from Deepak Chopra, which is, you know, just when you do something like that in your body, you have to physically think, my forehead. You know what I mean? And then you move into your sinus cavity, and then through your mouth, into your chin, and down your neck. So it's not just, oh, you know, my white blood cells are fighting. I'm literally going through every single square inch of my body and picturing those white blood cells being led by the generals of my medicine and fighting the virus. And there's a bunch of people right now listening to this go, this guy's a kook, but I'm here to tell you, I really think this has done something. The mental attitude, the positive attitude, and just the power behind that has actually been one of the major reasons that I'm still here today. I think a positive attitude goes a long way.
It does. The power of positive thinking is a positive weapon against almost anything. And, you know, so many people have written books about the power of positive thinking. And it's true. The problem is so many people do not allow themselves the time to actually believe in believing, so to speak, that it does work. Because if you feel like you're dying, you're going to die.
Yep.
And if you feel like you're going to live until your time is up, then you're going to live, and you're going to enjoy doing it by whatever means necessary. And I believe I was talking to my daughter-in-law earlier today, and I told her, I said, you know what? I said, if I were to drop dead right now, you make sure at my funeral that you tell everybody that I lived my life. I have no regrets. And I enjoy doing it. And I know that it's a job well done, because I know that I've touched some lives along the way. And there are always going to be people out there who don't like you, who are the doubters and the people who don't mean you any good and want you to fail. But, you know, those people have, that's their demon, and they'll have to deal with that.
Right.
But I know that whether it be one person, 100 people, 1,000 people, or a million or more, I know that each week what we do reaches so many people all over the world. And, you know, it's just amazing to me. And I want to reach out to as many people as I can and have so many people on here to tell their stories. And, you know, it's so nice when I get the wonderful responses back, and I know that you can relate to this. When someone sends you that wonderful response, and even tonight, you know, you've already inspired someone who took the time to go out and already get your book. So,
yeah,
you know, they've been quiet in the chat room, so they may be reading it, because I believe that they asked about Kindle, so 10-to-1 they've probably gotten it by now.
They can download it right then. Technology is amazing. I'll tell you, Maria, just in the short time that we've been talking, I honestly am amazed with you, and it's just such an exciting thing to be able to have this opportunity to talk to you, because I can see that we're kindred spirits, and I can see that you are an amazing person, and gosh, I'm just sorry that it's taken us this long to get to meet each other. I look forward to continued conversations and emails or what have you. I mean, I say we bounce back and forth and motivate each other.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. I don't know. You know, some people ask me how I can do what I do, and I tell them, I don't know. I just do it. And that's why, you know, every year when I put out the call, the new guest, and I tell people, and they always say, what are you going to ask me? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm like,
right.
We're just going to talk. I'm like, I want to get to know you, and that's why I like to have their materials. I said, I need to know who you are, because I want the listeners to feel our connection. And I do. I think that you're just great. And like I said, you're still down there in area right outside of D.C.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Born and raised.
So am I. So I work there. So I'm there every day. Maybe we'll get together and do lunch or something one day.
I love that
idea. Not too far from Quince Orchard. So, I'm down there a ways. And I go through Laytonville every day.
Laytonville, that's a great little place. Like you said, the speed bump capital. But so Quince Orchard, that's pretty much, I mean, I grew up in Rockville. And then my wife and I, you know, we moved out to Germantown. And so, I mean, mm-hmm. we've always been centered around the Quince Orchard area.
Yeah. Yeah, so maybe we'll do that one day when the weather breaks and, it's not so dark so I can get back uptown. Because, you know, that's a bit of a hike from there to home.
Yeah, when the weather's better, I'll come down on my Harley.
Oh, cool.
I'll bring an extra helmet.
You know, they come, the bikers, we always go out on Liberty because we like to see the biker boys.
Oh, yeah.
And all of them, they come in the summer, they go somewhere up in like Sykesville or Eldersburg. And
yep.
They have a place up there. And you can just see the Harley riders and all of the biker boys, and they head up 26 up to wherever they're going. So it's really cool. Yeah.
26 is how I went up to Rock State Park.
Yeah. Mhm.
That's a beautiful area.
Yeah. Oh gosh, yeah. It's beautiful out here anyway. And I mean they've really developed it over the years, but it's still pretty, you know, gorgeous out here, and even when I come up from down there, I take all the back roads just because. But we have less than a minute, so it has been great. Thank you so much for joining me here on Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio. And I feel as though I have another new friend, yes. And, of course, people, if you want to get with, if you want to talk to me also, you can reach me at Healing Through Hurt Talk Radio on Facebook. You can like us there and with everything. And, of course, Vaughn, we will be in touch. And we'll make some more great things happen. And, of course, I'll have you back for an update. And, of course, we didn't cover the entire book, but we will definitely be in touch and stay in touch and have you back soon for an update show. And like I said, maybe we'll, yeah, we will definitely get together, have lunch, and talk about the book and just shoot the breeze. So thank you again, and thank you, each and every one of you in our chat room and all of our listeners on our switchboard and those of you listening through our players. And if you missed the show, you can always hear it in its entirety when it archives. Until tomorrow morning at 9:30 a.m., you all have a blessed week, and I'll see you next week, Vaughn. Good night, and thank you again.
Thank you very much, Maria. I appreciate you chatting with me.
Oh, it was my pleasure. So I will talk to you soon.
Have a good night.
You too. Good night.
Oh, pretty baby, since you left me, I have been feeling oh so blue. I always thought that you would love me. I don't know what I should do. Do do ba ba da do da. Do do ba ba da do. Do do ba ba da do da. I don't know what I.